second career, parlay their leadership skills into higher-paying office jobs. But selling firearms was a surprise. I'm not sure why. I'd only worked with Nestor for an afternoon. I didn't know him. But I'd thought of him since then. An infatuation. Soft-spoken. A photographer. I wanted to hold him apart from the jocks and gun geeks I met on the job. But maybe I was imagining Nestor as something he wasn't. Or maybe something had happened to him since I'd known him. Something that had changed him. Strange paths lives can take. I thought of Nestor's story of his father. Doorways in the forest that led to other forests. Yeah, I'll track him down. See what he can tell me.
Anyone else you'll want to talk with? Anyone associated with the investigation?
He asked.
We can reach out on your behalf.
The woman. Anyango, I said. And I considered speaking with Brock. But Brock was dangerous to me here. He had been briefed about deep waters. He'd known about deep space then, and it was possible he had learned about deep time in the intervening years. We were trained to avoid contact with government or military personnel, who might understand the mechanics of time travel, who might understand that our appearance in their world meant their world would cease once we left. I knew an agent once, had known her as a 24-year-old woman when she launched, and saw her a few months later, after she'd returned to Terra Firma, deteriorated with weariness and old age. She had been imprisoned in her IF by someone from the Department of Homeland Security, was kept as an inmate at Holman Supermax for over 50 years. We called what she endured becoming a butterfly in a bell jar, a present danger to agents working in deep time. If Brock knew about time travel, he might capture me here and hold me for as long as I could be kept alive. Only Nicole and Yongo and Nestor, I said. At least at first. But I'll make contact with both of them on my own. I don't want to approach them as law enforcement. They might clam up. Investigating cold cases almost 20 years gone. Disheartening how little progress had been made in this investigation in all this time. As if the Mersault deaths were simply a fluke of violence. Stormy weather that struck and was swept away. Still, new information would shake out. Tracking down Nestor, tracking down Nicole and Yongo, interviewing her myself. People will often speak freely about tragedies long buried. Will say things that they wouldn't have said in the heat of their involvement. Relationships evolve, sour. People who wouldn't have talked then might talk now. I flipped back to Mersault's service record. Still not much, I said. Unauthorized absence, desertion, Zodiac, Libra. What about this? I asked. Any information about Libra? Or Zodiac? O'Connor tasked me to discover anything about Libra. And why Mersault and Elric Fleece weren't accounted for.
Nothing, said Najoku. Their appearance remains unexplained. Libra is still assumed lost.
There was a slim document, a perfect-bound booklet, the cover illustrated with the icon of the Naval Space Command, a gold anchor and ropes spanning an image of the globe. There was a second icon as well, a woman with flowing auburn hair raising a set of golden scales, the figure outlined by the house-shaped constellation. United States Navy, Naval Space Command Crew List, USS Libra. I flipped to Petty Officer First Class Patrick Mersault, Special Warfare Operator, and saw his photograph. Flint hard before the American flag, dress blues and white combination cap. Elric Fleece was here too, rated as electrician's mate. Nothing like the obese suicide I'd seen, but handsome, with full lips and studious in thick-lensed glasses. He'd worked odd jobs as an electrician, I remembered. And in this photo he looked like an earnest graduate student. I had no trouble imagining this man tinkering with motherboards in a basement workshop, cluttered with wires, a soldering iron in his hands.
NCIS tracked surviving relatives of every sailor listed for Libra. But we were asking questions about ghosts, said Najoku. Mersault and Fleece were posthumously convicted of desertion. We assume they weren't on Libra when it launched.
Libra's commander was a woman, Elizabeth Remark,
I scanned her service record. An academic. A PhD in engineering from MIT. Her hair was silvery, a feathery pixie cut. She was a young woman when she was given command. Born in 1951, she would have been 34 when she launched. Her eyes were deep blue, matching the star field of the flag behind her.
"I knew, Commander Remark," said Najoku.
"She was a friend."
"Did you serve together?"
"I was the agent afloat on the USS Cancer," said Najoku. "Remark was our engineer officer. Distinguished herself. She saved all our lives. They gave her command of Libra because of how she handled herself on Cancer."
"Only 3 Zodiac ships survived," I said. "The Cancer,
we launched in 1984. We're scheduled to make 5 separate jumps to deep time. But Remark discovered problems with the O-ring seals on the BL drive," said Najoku. "The seals were brittle. Weren't holding up. A common problem with ships of that era. We all thought the BL would misfire or explode. We thought we would all die. We're certain of it. Like we were living our last days in a floating tomb. But Remark and her team went to work. They made 18 separate spacewalks over the course of a month, replaced what they could, rebuilt the rest. Our commander aborted the rest of the mission, ordered us to sail home. The BL drive held."
"You did complete a jump, though," I asked. "The Cancer must have been the last ship to see a future without the Terminus."
"We sailed 5,000 years, said Najoku. "And I saw wonders, Shannon. Wonders I will never comprehend. The oceans were thick like honey. 55 billion people or more. Deserts. Everything sandswept. The old cities had fallen away, but new cities were built. Entire cities in the shape of black pyramids. Pyramids carried on the shoulders of the millions who lived in their shade. Entire generations were born, lived and died beneath the cities they carried. Moving cities wandering to find water. The people below were starving, naked, subsisting on scraps and detritus left by the kings who lived inside the pyramids."
"Maybe the Terminus is a mercy," I said. Najoku snapped from his reverie.
"I can tell you the rich were doing well for themselves," he said. "Inside the pyramids were pleasure gardens, grottos, fountains. Our crew was welcomed like we were long-lost children, prodigals shown every comfort. Every illness cured if you could afford the cure. And some people had left their bodies entirely, had become immortal, living as waves of light. But once they could no longer die, the immortals begged for death, because life without the passage of time becomes meaningless. It used to be thought that hell was a lack of God, but hell is a lack of death."
Najoku finished the last of his tea, checked the time, nearing 10 at night.
"I should let you sleep," he said. "But I'm curious. What was the last moment you remember before coming here?"
"Hale-bopp was in the sky," I said. Najoku's smile seeped through his concentration.
"Of course. Of course I remember. I remember that time very well. You launched in March, didn't you? Of 1997. My God. I was stationed at the Boston office. So I'm still in Boston, in Terra Firma. I was collaborating on a project with physicists at MIT. Wave function collapse. Brandt LaMonaco space-time knots. Just a few weeks later, I met Jayla. She was a professor of saxophone performance, played in a trio at the time. I remember watching her play. I remember the sounds she made, her fingers pressing the keys, the sound of her breath. We've been married now for 17 years. But, oh, I remember that time."
"So, in Terra Firma, you only have a few weeks to live before your life changes forever," I said.
"Lovely, Shannon. That is a lovely thought."
"I am ready to relieve you," I said, once we shook hands goodnight. The traditional phrasing NSC sailors spoke on parting. The tacit acknowledgement that when I returned home aboard the Grey Dove, Every moment of Najoku's life that had been lived after March of 1997 would blink out of existence. This entire universe, the fully formed entirety of this if, would vanish as suddenly as a passing thought. Rather than the traditional response of, "I am ready to be relieved," however, Najoku merely smiled.
"It was difficult to accept that my life was an illusion," he said. "Whether you're NCIS or NSC, when you're told the secrets of deep waters, you agree that you might have to lay down your life for your country. That theoretically, at any moment, you might come into the realization that your life is an illusion. You rationalize it. You say that soldiers give their lives for their country, that police officers give their lives. They lay down their lives for a greater good. But still, even though I know the physics, on some level I refuse to believe that if I ever encountered you, Shannon Moss, it would prove that this entire universe was just some sort of pocket universe that would blink out once you'd left. When O'Connor assigned you to me, it was like he handed down my death sentence. Can you understand that? I'm married. I have children. And my children have grown and are ready to have children of their own. But every happy moment in my life was tempered by knowing that what I was experiencing wasn't real.
But you are real, where I come from. You'll still live this life, I said.
Dr. Wally Najoku might be real. He might meet Jayla in a few weeks, like you said. He might even have a family. But he won't have the same family. What are the odds of one particular spermatozoan fertilizing one particular egg? Najoku might have children, but they won't be the same children. They won't be mine. He'll be happy, but it won't be my happiness.
I know, I told him. I understand, I do.
But I came to accept that my existence is an illusion. Have you ever seen a flower called the falling star as it blooms? He asked. I saw one. This was several years ago, in summer. I was taking a walk with Jayla when we passed a neighbor's garden and noticed a certain flower in early bloom. She pointed it out to me and I was transfixed. A single stem, every bud perfectly symmetrical. The color was orange, almost like fire. I was struck because the first two buds to bloom at the base of the stem were in full flower. But the next two buds up the line had only just begun to bloom. The next two buds were smaller still and so on, all the way up to the tip of the stem, where the flowers were merely two closed buds that had yet to open at all. This was the Crocosmia, the Lucifer, but Jayla knew it as the falling star. I understand that we physicists interpret existences as something like a symptom of wave function collapse, some quantum illusion to exploit. A brief fermata of indeterminacy. But I prefer to think of myself and all myselves as the falling star. Every permutation of every choice I've ever made and ever will make, existing in every moment, forever. Merrily, merrily, isn't that what the truest sailors say? Nothing blinks out, nothing ends. Everything exists. Always exists. Life is but a dream, Shannon. Self is the only illusion.
I left Oceana the following morning, in the car that had been requisitioned for me, a beige sedan. I drove from Naval Air Station Oceana north through D.C. to pick up the Pennsylvania Turnpike west, thinking of the falling star. My car was electric, battery-powered, the engine silent, a constant worry that I had slipped into neutral and was coasting. Caffeine helped me overcome the sensation of being caught in a waking dream. I ordered a black coffee at a Starbucks near an outlet mall in Fredericksburg. Country music on the radio. Songs I'd never heard before and might not ever hear again. But once the mountains turned FM into static, I scanned AM until I found a minister speaking about the resurrection. "Do you believe in the resurrection of the body?" Something Nestor had asked me.
through the Allegheny Mountain Tunnel. Isolated houses, tobacco barns fallen into ruin. I watched hawks circle above conical salt cellars. What had this drive been like the last time I'd made it? Less than a year ago in my world, but almost 20 years ago in this one. What had the scenery been? Trying to figure out what was new, what was lost. Yards full of junk and houses lined with rusted scaffolding. Communications towers, a white church in a valley near Breezewood. Newer service plazas, motion-sensor toilets that flushed by themselves. I had to charge my engine by plugging in. The changes of the intervening years registered more acutely as I neared Cannonsburg. Industrial parks and gleaming office cubes, and sprouts of housing developments in what had once been only vacant green hills. The hills were cluttered with white windmills, lazily spinning, and I saw entire fields of solar panels where there had once been crops. Driving into Cannonsburg still felt like coming home. The drive downhill on Morganza was the same, as was the Pizza Hut that edged Chartier's Creek. I checked with the Cannonsburg Police Department and found my mom still alive. Her address listed as room 405 at Townville Health and Rehabilitation. Up the hill on Bar, already dusk when I pulled into the lot. Women in wheelchairs taking in the evening air, old men smoking. Jeopardy in the rec room, a hand of euchre. I scanned the card players, nervous to see her, wondering how much she'd changed. An elevator to the fourth floor, framed paintings of cottages, flora. Mom often said she never wanted to end up in a place like this, said I should kill her before I let that happen. The door to 405 was open, the television blaring. The room was sterile in the way of doctor's offices, the color scheme nothing that would have been chosen for a home, blue and fuchsia with white-flowered wallpaper. A food tray was swiveled over the bed, plastic dishes and a carton of milk, the same sort kindergartners would drink from. Potted hyacinths were on the nightstand, filling the room with sweetness that masked the earthier smells of my mother's body. "I think my dosage is off," she said. "I've been drowsy." I flinched at the concavities of her face when she turned toward me. The shape of my mother's head was different. Tucked in. A significant part of her jaw had been removed. She looked mummy-like. Bandage-wrapped bed sores on her forearms and bed sheets over her legs. "Mom?" I said. "Oh," she said. "Oh, I thought you were the nurse." "Shannon." "It's me, Mom."
"It can't be. I don't believe you."
Mom propped herself up on her elbows, her gown falling away to reveal the skin of her shoulders, even more supple with age, softer, it seemed, and coated with white down. Her hair was mussed. It looked greasy, like it hadn't been washed in several days.
"You haven't changed a day," she said. "Look at you, Shannon. Where have you been? You left me. You left me bereft. You left me alone."
"I was deployed," I said, a lie made no less vile because it was in some sense true. "I had to go."
"Look at me,"
she said, tugging her gown back over her shoulders.
"I'm so embarrassed. You shouldn't see me like this. You shouldn't see your own mother like this. You should have told them you were coming. I could have dressed."
Her expressions were altered because of her surgeries. Scars like white worms wriggled on her jowls and throat when she talked. I said, "Mom, it's all right. I like seeing you."
"New nurses come in here every day, and they don't take care of me." "Sweetie? Sweetie, are you out there? Come here, sweetie."
"I'm here," I said. But when I took a step closer to the bed, Mother said, "Not you." A woman appeared in the doorway, A hoary woman in a wheelchair, her hair a tangle of steel wool. Sweetie pulled herself along with her white sneakers and her hands on the wheels, tucked herself inside the room and stared at me.
"This is the one I told you about, sweetie," said Mom. "The daughter."
"I'm Shannon," I said, realizing I'd been damned during my years of absence. "A pleasure to meet you." Sweetie laughed, a horrible wheezing.
"Sweetie's my friend, my only friend," said Mother. "We call this place our ghost house because we feel like ghosts here."
"Sure enough," said Sweetie.
I pulled a chair over to my mother's bedside, took one of her hands. She was insubstantial, just bones and veins and a wrapping paper of skin. "What happened?" I asked. "You've been sick."
"I'm told I'm a tough old bird, Shannon," she said. "Too gamey for death to eat."
"Cancer in her intestines and in her mouth," she explained. "The doctors broke her jaw and removed the cancerous half. They cut apart her throat, cut open her intestines, and clipped out the affected lengths, leaving her with a colostomy bag."
"All I ate was Ensure," she said. "Seemed like years. I had a feeding tube right in my stomach for such a long time. Right here," she said, pointing just above her belly button. "I turned skinny."
"You were always skinny," I said.
"It's hard for me to chew, even still. I can't eat very much. I don't think these nurses know what they're doing."
She'd barely nibbled the cut of turkey and mashed potatoes on her dinner tray.
19 years, she said. "You disappeared in 1997. You never came back. You never said goodbye. What do you think about that, sweetie? Your boy's no good, I've met him. Always trying to take your money. But at least he comes to see you. My daughter left me."
"No good," sweetie said.
"They experimented on me," said Mom. "After they butchered me like this. Some doctor paid me a visit. This salesman said I was terminal but an ideal candidate, and they wanted to know if I'd accept $1,000 to be part of their trials. I was one of the first in the entire country. 3 injections, that's all. Tiny robots swimming in my blood, finding cancer cells and killing them. After all these years, all this suffering, 3 injections. You can tell your children someday how their grandmother was part of the first trials."
"A cure for cancer? That's miraculous," I said. I'd heard rumors of far future ifs where diseases had been solved, but a cure for cancer by 2015? "They cured you."
"A guinea pig," she said. "I got lucky. Could never afford it otherwise. Can I tell you about a dream I had? A dream about you. After you disappeared, and I gave up hoping you'd ever come back. I dreamed I was walking down a street, one of those streets in Europe. Old buildings, old apartments. I heard a cracking sound, and saw the wall of the building had cracked. I heard snapping wood, the floorboards. The apartment was on fire, and I saw flames rush from the windows. Bright orange flames that reached into the sky. You were just a child, playing on the sidewalk. My sweet child. I ran to you. I scooped you up just before the house collapsed. I saved you, Shannon. But when I looked to see you in my arms, you disappeared."
"Only a dream," I said.
A horrible thing to dream, she said.
We sat with Sweetie for over an hour, most of the time passing in silence, the three of us staring passively at the television. A singing contest, with judges spinning in futuristic thrones. A nurse changed my mother's colostomy bag, a flush of embarrassment on my mother's behalf. A woman given up to this male nurse who handled her body like it was nothing. Nothing more than a trash can that needed emptying.
You left me. Just like he did, she said, knowing where to bury the knife.
I was deployed, I said again. The lie hollow this second time.
Deployed. Always deployed. You lost your leg. You aged. You aged horrifically. Always so old. Too old. Always getting so old I thought you and I were the same age. But now you're here, and you haven't aged in 20 years. It's a sickness.
I was at sea.
19 years without a word. You and your father.
I know, I said.
Do you even remember your father? She asked. He left when you were young, but I bet you remember something.
Nothing but images. Shattered, stained glass I hoped could be reformed into the image of a saint. I remember the photograph we had of him on the mantle, I said. That's mostly how I remember him.
That's how I wanted you to remember your father when you were younger. I wanted you to have good memories.
I remember him lifting me into the air, I said.
I used to wonder if you could smell that other woman on him, said my mother.
Please don't.
You're not that delicate, are you? You come back after all these years, and you expect me not to compare you to him. We're all adults here. Or is it that you want to be faithful to him? She said. He's not worth it. I could smell her on him when he came home too late for dinner. And then he'd hug you, and I'd wonder if you could smell her. Isn't that awful? A woman wondering if her baby girl knew what the smell of another woman was.
Father smelled like pipe smoke, his breath sometimes like wintergreen. We don't need to talk about this, I said. Very few memories of my father. Flannel shirts and blue jeans. Or maybe just one memory spread out over years. Pipe smoke. Wintergreen. Scruffy. I remembered him with a beard, or stubble, even though the image of him that I remember most clearly was the picture on the mantle. A young sailor, clean cut. I remember his flannel shirts, I said.
I don't believe in you, said my mother. I think you're a dream, or a nightmare I'm having. Am I dreaming, sweetie? I hope we're dreaming, you and me, said her friend. You can't just disappear for 19 years, said Mother. You and your father.
Excuse me, I said, stepping away, refusing to cry in front of her. The hallway air was stale with medicinal smells and disinfectant. Somewhere, in some other room, a woman screamed, and it sounded like she was burning alive. I had to remind myself that this world was false, that her accusations against me were false. It was my father who'd abandoned us. I felt guilty for something I hadn't done. I never abandoned her. Would be with her again when I returned from this if, as if no time had gone by. No time for her, at least. When I thought of the picture of my father on our mantle, I always gave him the benefit of the doubt. Always on some level blaming my mother for his leaving us. Unfair of me, but I think of my mother at the call center. A failure at her grander dreams. A drunk. The hours at McGrogan's siphoning off her life,
And I think, no wonder the man left us. I resented her for losing him. She gave him away. She gave away everything and kept nothing.
Sweetie and my mother had returned their attention to the television, a vacant smile twisting my mother's face as she hummed along with one of the contestants on the show.
Mom?
Too late. Too late, she said.
My mother settled into her pillow, closed her eyes. I kissed her forehead, her skin clammy, sweat-scented. I began to cry harder, this if dredging up too much pain.
Only a version of the truth, I told myself.
Ifs warping around the mind of the observer, a black hole warping light. I always wondered if I took after my father, sometimes hoping I took after him, imagining his intricate inner life. A marked contrast to Mom, who always looked outward. I felt so alone after Courtney had died, and I wanted her then, wanted my mom. Wanted her to show me how to bear such loss. But she was distant. Her circle at McGrogan's, her late nights, while her daughter drifted unmoored. I used to think that my father had tried to love her, but that she was never there for him, that she had eventually pushed him away. I used to daydream of leaving her too, resentful. But she was the one who stayed for me when he had left us. She had stayed even while everyone in her life abandoned her. While I abandoned her. Sweetie's brown eyes were pools inviting me to drown.
We'll keep each other, she said. When she wakes up, I'll tell her you were just a haunt. A wayward.
I found one of Mom's nurses at the call station, clicking fingernails against the screen of her phone.
Excuse me, I said. My mother was treated for cancer. She mentioned an injection therapy. Amanda Moss?
The nurse seemed annoyed to have been pulled away from her screen. She slapped a pamphlet down on the counter. Non-invasive cancer therapy. Phasal Systems. I was aware of Phasal, a spin-off company from the Naval Research Lab. In most other ifs, Phasal had grown into a communications and entertainment behemoth. The makers of ambient systems. Phasal was pharmaceutical here. Other ifs might have the miracle of ambient systems instead of smartphones, but here there was a cure for cancer. Cell-specific medicine delivery. Smart meds. Nanotech injections.
She got the cancer cure through government assistance, said the nurse. But you have to be rich to live forever.
I checked into a Red Roof Inn that accepted cash. A business center, a room off the lobby equipped with computers, a printer. I logged on with my keycard. Google easy enough once the front desk clerk showed me where to click. Hours researching Marion, scribbling notes on hotel stationery. Philip Nestor plus West Virginia hit a website called The Eagle's Nest. World War II memorabilia. The shop tab displayed a grid of Nazi artifacts, flags, and antique weapons. I bristled at the swastikas, wondering if this was even the same person I had known, or if I was tracking the wrong Philip Nestor. Not much information on the webpage, but appearances listed upcoming shows. The Monroeville Guns and Ammo show a few weekends away. I could find them there. Scant results for Nicole Onyango. The woman in Mersault's photographs. I landed on a PDF of a sheriff's document that indicated a stint in county jail, drug-related. Even more reason not to flash a badge and pepper her with questions about a past murder. Najoku's file mentioned she was habitual at a bar called Mayor's Inn. I thought of my mother. Oh, if she wasn't at home, she would be at McGrogan's. The name of Nicole Onyango's bar rang a bell, and I checked the address. Knew where the place was, just a 10-minute drive from the Red Roof into downtown Washington on South Main. Almost midnight, but a good chance it would be open. So I took my keycard from the computer and drove over. The Mayor's Inn was a dive in a row of mostly abandoned storefronts nestled near the Bradford House, a stone Georgian from the 1700s, a whiskey rebellion house. No windows, just an emerald green front door beneath an awning. Smoking permitted. Wednesday wings. I parked out front on the empty street. Mayor's was lit with neon, and the television glow above the bar was vague with hanging smoke. A narrow space, the clack of pool balls in a back room, Zeppelin on the jukebox. The place was nearly empty, but she sat at the bar, her cigarette smoldering as she spoke with the bartender. Nicole Onyango was older than in the photographs I'd seen of her. Taller than I would have guessed, but her movements were as sinuous as the trail of smoke that rose from her cigarette. She noticed me watching her. Her eyes were startling, the color of teak, but laconic. Her expression like she already doubted anything I would ever say.
"Can I get you anything?"
from the bartender. "Just looking for someone," I said, leaving. The FBI had interviewed the woman. Nestor had interviewed her. NCIS would have talked with her too, maybe O'Connor. Even if she'd been emotionally insulated near the time when Rissolt was killed, she might talk now. She had been close with Rissolt. Her memories of the man were valuable to me. A dilapidated building stood next door to Mayor's, a sign out front. Room vacancy. I jotted down the landlord's number, called once I was back at the Red Roof. Almost 1 o'clock in the morning, expecting to leave a message on a machine, but a man's voice answered. His accent Eastern European, almost too thick to understand.
"Come by tomorrow," he said. "Morning. I'll give you keys then."
"Is it okay if I pay with cash?" I asked.
"Cash only," he said.
I handed him the security deposit and first month's rent the next morning. No lease, month-to-month payments. I moved in that afternoon. The apartment, a one-bedroom unit on the third floor. No elevator. Musty. I used a butter knife to chip away paint from the windows before I could slide them open. Worn wood floors. The molding painted with several coats of cream. The kitchen sink had the same faucet I remembered from my grandmother's house. The cabinets were similar, too. A moment of lensing, I guessed. Details existing only because I was the one here to observe them. This apartment might be slightly different in terra firma. I had brought tablets of Red Roof Inn stationery with me, sat at an antique writing desk that had come with the room, sketching, eventually sketching skeletons, crucified. "Patrick Mersault," I wrote. "Elric Fleece. Libra." I thought of Remark, the commander of Libra, of how she had saved the cancer. "O-ring seals," I wrote, wondering if Libra's O-ring seals had failed. But wouldn't Remark have known? Wouldn't she have saved Libra as she had saved cancer? I tore my notes into small pieces and looked again at Remark's picture in the Libra crew list. An attractive woman. Dashing. Even in this photograph, she looked like she could outmaneuver the world. What happened to you? Several weeks before Nestor would be at the gun show in Monroeville, where I would ask him what he remembered about Patrick Mersault and Marion's death and discovery, how it had all played out. I had time on my hands. I wandered downtown Washington most mornings, picking up the texture of this place, and spent some time at the mall, where I bought clothes to match the styles of other women I saw. Comfy clothes, a mountaineer sweatshirt, athletic-fit tank tops, yoga pants. L'Oreal rinse out dye to match my driver's license, a luxurious brunette color that brought out my sharper features, my cheekbones, my jawline. I felt tougher, more pugnacious than as a blonde. Mayor's most nights, becoming a regular, and Nicole there most nights too. She came there to smoke and drink and watch TV, the two of us sitting just a few seats from each other, passing the time in silence until a week or so had passed, rounding toward midnight on a Thursday, after we'd both built up a pretty good buzz. An early snowstorm had kicked up, people coming into Mayor stamping their shoes and shaking snow from their collars. I'd learned she drank Manhattans, so I bought her a drink. "I'm Courtney, by the way," I told her, thickening the Guntown drawl that had always played at the edge of my voice anyway. About time I introduced myself.
Cole,
she'd said, her African accent lilting, melodic. We shook hands, her palms rough, almost calloused, it felt like. She wore a bracelet in the shape of a serpent. Nicole slid a seat closer to mine, lit one of her parliaments.
You live around here?
Right next door, I said. In that shithole, the white building. I got an apartment there a few days ago, so I drink here and just stumble upstairs when they kick me out.
At first I thought maybe you were with the gas companies when you started showing up, said Nicole. But then I thought I recognized you. Have we met before?
I don't think so. You go to high school around here? I was at Canmac.
I grew up in Kenya, she said. What do you drink?
Rum and cherry coke. She bought our next round. She proved chatty, eager to talk, filling my ear with the details of her routine, the grind of working in hospice care. I pushed her toward her past, blunt questions about old boyfriends, hoping she would mention something about Patrick Mersault that I could pry into. But I learned the minutiae of the Donnell House instead. The staff there, the joys of helping people and the guilty relief that flooded Nicole whenever one of her more difficult residents finally succumbed. Occurrences she celebrated with a shot of Jägermeister. I saw Nicole nearly every night at Mayor's. Some nights just enjoying the bar, the atmosphere, enjoying her company, her chatter. Some nights, I let myself forget all about Shannon Moss and lived as Courtney Gim. Easy to adopt a new life and let my old life dissolve. Nothing was urgent here. No matter how long I lived here, I would return to the present in the moment I had left. I could let time pass here, live whatever life I wanted. I could forget myself here. So I reminded myself often of why I'd come. Every night before I slept, I looked at a photograph of Marion Mersault I kept on my writing desk. You're alive, I'd whisper. You're still alive. I placed a sheet of Red Roof stationery beside the picture and wrote in black Sharpie, Life is greater than time. 2. Signs lined old William Penn Highway. Guns and ammo, this weekend. I found the convention center out by the Monroeville Mall, next to a Babies R Us, the lot full, spillover parking in the lot of the abandoned big box across the street. $9 tickets to get into the show, the ticket taker asking if I was carrying a weapon. No need for pretense, fake IDs, as Nestor might recognize me anyway. I showed my badge. Naval Criminal Investigative Service.
Are you with Gibbs?
He asked. I don't know what that is.
From the TV show,
he said, tearing my ticket, stamping my hand with an eagle. I'm a federal agent.
You know, the TV show,
he said. Snaking lines of folding tables filled out the convention hall. I looked through the crowds for Nestor. Ammo and beef jerky vendors. Some tables like a flea market of random junk. Old AK-47 banana clips and rusted-out Winchesters. Tables of blades. Switchblade knives with jewel-colored handles. Neon green axes labeled for hunting and killing zombies. I wondered if that was actually a thing. Someone asked if I needed a canister of mace to keep in my purse.
You'd look good in this one,
one of the sellers said, a woman with platinum curls, holding up the skimpiest pink tank top, Hello Kitty with an AK-47, Kalashnikov Kitty. Other t-shirts, the Pillsbury Doughboy in a Nazi armband, white flower. Shirts for the USMC, the Screaming Eagles. Browsing guns, I liked the feel of weapons with wooden stocks. The warmth and heft, rather than the plasticky feel of some semi-automatic rifles. My attention caught on pink camo shotguns meant for gun babes, I figured. But there were only a half dozen other women here, and they didn't look like the pink camo type to me.
My God. Shannon Moss? Is that you?
Nestor? In his 30s then. He'd be in his 50s now. Handsome still. His eyes were still stunning. I'd almost forgotten how brilliant. Powder blue, lit from within. His hair had grown a shade darker, and his mustache and scruffy beard had gone gray at the tips. He'd been thin before, but even so he'd lost weight. Wiry, like a long-distance runner. Flannel, blue jeans. His table was called the Eagle's Nest, a picker's table. Nazi gear, almost all of it. Antique rifles, bayonets, a glass case of pistols, P-38s and Lugers, matched with patches from the officers who'd carried them, letters of authenticity. Some American stuff, an autographed picture of Patton. Nestor came around from behind his table.
"It is you,"
he said, and he hugged me. Pipe smoke. It felt good to put my arms around him.
"You haven't changed," he said. "I mean, you haven't changed. You look just like I remember you. Look at you. How long has it been?"
19 years, about," I said.
19, he said. "You know, when I first saw you coming up the aisle, I thought I recognized you. But my first thought was you might be your daughter."
"No, no kids."
"Let me look at you," he said. "God, you look damn good, I'm telling you. You took care of yourself."
"Well, I don't feel so young," I said. "Dyeing my hair now."
"I noticed. It looks good," said Nestor. "I like the dark hair."
"All the gray. I had to do something."
"I'll be honest. I'm happy to see you. You just left," he said. "And then, I thought you might have, you know, with Seegis, when Seegis was attacked. Your office was in Seegis, wasn't it? I'm remembering that right?"
"It was," I said. "But I was at sea. I've been at sea."
"You know about Brock?"
he asked.
"I mean, about his wife. Lost his wife at Seegis. His two daughters also."
"Rashonda," I said. "I haven't seen Brock since Scannonsburg. How is he?"
"They used the daycare at that building," said Nestor. "He lost everyone, and never really got over it. Never remarried or anything. Just buried himself in his work. Kept busy. He's all right, last time we talked. You know, he got all those promotions. He's at Quantico now. I used to ask him if he knew what happened with you, but he didn't know. No one seemed to know. We figured you might have been caught up in the attack, too. But you're here. I used to look through the names of everyone that was killed. All those memorials they televised. But you're here. My God, Shannon, it's good to see you."
His demeanor had changed. Chattier. A man used to patter, but his voice had the warmth I remembered. "How about you?" I asked him. "What is all this stuff?"
"The Eagle's Nest. Takes up all my time. This was my dad's collection. He was a hoarder. Anything military. World War One or Two. I was just going to sell all this stuff off at once, but a buddy of mine convinced me to do gun shows. And I've been at this almost 6 years, I guess. I do American memorabilia, British, but the Nazi pieces are the big sellers here. It beats a desk job."
"You aren't with the Bureau anymore?"
"Not for a long time,"
he said.
"I'll tell you what. Let me get my neighbor over here to watch my table for a while. Do you have a few minutes? I'll buy you some lunch. Their chicken fingers aren't bad."
I accepted a cup of coffee. The convention center's cafe was near the bathrooms, a few tables set out. The coffee Nestor handed me smelled a little like barbecue sauce, and I barely sipped it, but was happy to hold something warm. Nestor's forehead wrinkled as he talked, just like I remembered, only the creases were deeper. His eyebrows were bushier, softer. "It's good to see you," I told him. A familiarity between us. I had barely known him in 1997, and even though the years were a gulf between us, I felt like no time had passed at all, like we were resuming a conversation neither one of us had wanted to end.
"What brings you around?"
he asked. You? I said. What have you been up to?
I quit the bureau. 2008. Did some freelance photography for a while. The work I do now suits me. I travel the circuit, meet people. It's all right. I've always been interested in history.
You've lost weight, I said. You're just a skinny thing. Look at you.
Yeah, well,
he said. Moved back to West Virginia? I asked. You grew up in Twilight?
Always been my home. I have a house just outside this little town called Buchanan,
he said.
Quiet. Away from everything. They have a good strawberry festival every year.
I used to go there as a kid, I said. Strawberry parfaits and idolizing the strawberry pageant queen in the parade. I imagined Nestor with his camera, snaps of Americana. I haven't been in years.
Sure. You grew up around here, he said. You grew up in Cannonsburg, right? You grew up in our crime scene.
Why Buchanan? I asked.
Things just came together. I needed a place with a garage to store all my junk. The place I have has a small barn on the property. You should see it sometime. I get pickers coming through to look at the war stuff.
That sounds like a nice life.
It's a better life than the one I had,
he said. I don't want to dance around something, I said. What happened? Why'd you leave the bureau?
You know, you take something like what happened out in Nevada a couple years ago, said Nestor. All the FBI ready to storm that man's ranch. And for what? Over cattle grazing? What's the point of that? Of all that violence? I just couldn't take part anymore, I guess. Couldn't be a jackboot.
He lost himself staring out over the heads of everyone at the gun show, the clamor of the convention hall grown distant. He cleared his throat, coughed.
I was involved in a use of force incident. I took someone's life. That shook me, almost destroyed me. I was having trouble handling what happened and just couldn't deal with all the political bullshit, all the bureau's bullshit,
he said.
Drank too much, I admit. For a time, I had to come to terms with a few things.
You're all right now? I asked.
I'm all right,
he said.
So you tracked me down, came all the way out to Monroeville to see me.
I need to talk with you about Marion Mersault, I said.
Marion Mersault,
said Nestor, running his palm over his chest, reacting as if the name wounded him.
Why her?
She was found, I said.
We found her. Long after.
I read up about the investigation, but I need particulars, I said.
After all this time? For what?
He asked, his forehead rippling, an expression like begging for mercy.
Why?
I've been assigned to a review board, I told him. A standard cover that didn't inspire questions, vaguely administrative. The tediousness of paperwork. She was found out near Blackwater Falls.
Out in the woods, that's right. Buried out in the Blackwater Gorge,
he said.
You, showing up here. You're like a ghost asking about ghosts. You really want to talk about that, Marion Mersault?
I need to know what you can tell me about her, I said.
Why don't you go through the bureau? Why track me down? Brock's still around out in Virginia. He can talk with you. He'd know more.
I need to talk with you, I said.
Not here, though,
said Nestor.
I don't want to get into all that stuff here. Hell, most of these people, if they found out I used to work with the FBI, they'd blacklist me. They'd think I was spying on them. Can you meet up? Tonight, even? This whole show closes down at 4.
Anywhere, I said. Where are you staying?
I'm heading back home tonight,
he said.
You want to have dinner before I go? There's a place over here some of us went to last night, the Wooden Nickel.
You're down in Buchanan. That's not too far from the Blackwater, I said. Can you show me where you found her?
Seriously? After all these years, you track me down and want me to take you out there? Well, what the hell? It would take a few hours to get there and back, said Nestor. It'll get dark. How are you with your leg? Can you hike at all?
I can hike.
All right. Well, why don't we meet at the lodge, then? Blackwater Lodge. I can leave a little early from here, meet you down there. Let's say by 6 or 6:30. I didn't get a chance to buy you chicken fingers, but I'll get you dinner after. I know a place.
I arrived early, 20 minutes or so, waiting in the car with the radio on, shredding the napkin that came with my Starbucks into tinier and tinier scraps of confetti, ashamed at how nervous I was. Nestor had said I was like a ghost asking about other ghosts. Waiting for him outside the Blackwater Lodge, not yet dark, but I remembered how black the woods were that night. The hemlock pines around the lodge seemed to have grown denser over the years, this whole place thick with ghosts. A feeling like I could walk back to Cabin 22 and still see Patrick Mersault slumped there, drained of life. Nestor pulled his F-150 beside my Camry and waved me into the cab. "Are you driving?" I asked.
"We can only get one car up there."
We left the main roads, taking narrower routes that cut uphill, the towering pines cooling what little remained of the day.
"Shannon, I don't understand how you can still look so young."
"Come on," I said.
"I'm serious, Shannon," said Nestor. "I turned into an old man, and you look..."
"Thanks, but I don't know. I work out, I eat right," I said.
"Well, you figured it out,"
he said.
"You should write a book about the Fountain of Youth, I'm telling you. You could be a millionaire on the talk shows."
Nestor turned onto a path just wide enough for his truck, an access route or maybe a logging road that rushed uphill at a dizzying incline. The truck wheels spun out, but Nestor gunned the gas. The tires caught and the truck lurched upward. I leaned back in the seat holding on, imagining the truck would tip backward, like we'd fall end over end.
"Here we are. They still have the trail marked."
Nestor pointed ahead, and I saw an orange ribbon tied around a tree trunk. He maneuvered his truck, scraping against the pines, to where the path leveled out into a narrow clearing where he could park.
"This was as far as any of the trucks could get,"
he said.
"Couldn't get an ambulance up here, so they brought her body down in the back of a pickup."
Her body. Careful of my footing, climbing from the cab. The pines were silhouetted, but the sky overhead was a circle of evening, a violet eye staring down on us. Colder here.
"We still have to walk," said Nestor. "A little."
The trail we followed was obscured by underbrush, but Nestor could still pick it out, stomping at the growth and holding back branches so I could make my way behind him, single file. We climbed a progression of naturally formed steps, clinging to trees for balance. He brought me to a runnel that might have been a creek, long dried. A bracket of 5 hemlock trees, black soil, emerald moss furring half-submerged stones.
"Here,"
said Nestor. "Marion," I thought. "This is where they found your body."
"This place was discovered by accident," said Nestor. "A couple ginseng diggers came through. I'd gotten lost higher up the elevation and figured they would hit the river if they just kept walking downhill. Figured they could follow the river back to the falls. Up the hill a bit, they found the first of what we called cairns. These stacks of flat rocks. Markers. They figured maybe some other diggers were marking a patch, so they came further down and spotted another cairn. And another. The cairns seemed to lead them to this spot, where we're standing. I don't see the cairns anymore. Someone must have knocked them down. Do you know what I'm describing? These markers?"
"Yeah, I guess so," I said. "Stacks of rocks."
"So these guys stopped to take a look around. Well, they spotted the red berries, so they knew they actually found some ginseng here. They dug for roots, but found bones instead. Thought maybe an animal was buried here, but knew the whole setup wasn't quite right. They abandoned their dig and called in what they found."
"You dug her up?"
"Park Service,"
said Nestor.
"Found human remains, called us in. And we figured right away. We just knew. It's funny. I remember when Brock came into the meeting room, he said, they found Marion. All we knew